Hey folks, welcome back to Indaba Africa. This is Chris once again coming to you live from central Pennsylvania. Very excited today. The holidays, the festive season interrupted the plans to make this happen, but it's probably best we deal with this now in this year. I'm very excited to bring on my guest in just a moment. I'll introduce him as we go on here. But I've been hoping to do this interview for some time. As you know, I'm giving an opportunity for opposition parties in South Africa to have a chance to share their views and their party platforms and things in advance of the 2021 municipal elections in South Africa, which could be a landmark election depending on how things go. But my guest today is Major General retired Bantu Holomisa, who is a member of parliament in South Africa, also the president of the United Democratic Movement, a party that he started back in the 1990s with Rolf Meyer. And he's going to be on with us in just a moment, but he's got quite an impressive resume. If you're not familiar with it, he enlisted in the Transkei Defense Force back in the 1970s, 76, got commissioned in 78. By 85, he's already Brigadier General, later became the leader of the Transkei, one of the former Bantustans, so-called Bantustans in South Africa. We'll talk a little bit about that today. And then was involved in the CODESA, the Convention for Democratic South Africa, as the lead delegate for the Transkei, one of the many groups that were at CODESA, working towards a democratic South Africa. And then after that, was in the government, the Deputy Minister of Tourism, if I recall correctly. And then he testified before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the ANC was not happy about that. The African National Congress did not like what he had to say, and he said that he was simply stating what occurred. At least I'll give him a chance to correct the record if I got that wrong. And he broke with the ANC and founded the United Democratic Movement. He's been in Parliament since then and sits on different committees. And ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome in my guest today, Member of Parliament, retired Major General Bantu Holomisa. Sir, welcome.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you to our viewers.
It's a pleasure to have you. I'm really excited about this. Wow, you know, when I do my show, people are always like, "Man, you have such an impressive resume," and it's, you know, you've got to be humble in life, right? And so I try to be humble, but then I look at your resume, I'm like, I feel like a piker. I think my resume doesn't even come close to yours. Yours is quite impressive. You've done so many things, been involved in so many things. You were one of the first Black South African officers to attend what became the Executive National Security Program, or the equivalent, kind of like the War College there in South Africa. That in itself is quite an achievement, but quite a long history here. And I think a lot of people don't know that your father was a traditional chief. Is that correct, back in the day?
Yeah. Yes, he was a chief at Mkanduli, in one of the districts or regions in the Eastern Cape.
He also served in the Transkei Legislative Assembly at one point too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he was a member of the Transkei Legislative Assembly.
Now, I'm going to apologize if I mispronounce your father's name, but I'll do my best here. Let me. I don't want to, so people know what his name is. Is it pronounced Bazindlovu?
Oh, well said.
Okay,
I well got done.
Well, thank you, thank you. Well, you always have to be careful with surnames, whether they're Afrikaans or they're Xhosa or they're Zulu. Sometimes it can be a bit challenging for folks not from the region. But it's a pleasure to have you on today, and we're going to talk a little bit about the 2021 elections, but let's talk a little bit about your history there. So you joined the Transkei Defense Force, and a lot of my audience is international, so they don't know what the Transkei was. It was one of these so-called independent countries that were created by the government of South Africa back starting in the late 70s, early 80s. Is that correct?
Yes, it was established in 1976 as an independent state. It was one of the one of the Bantustans in South Africa. And then 1976, it was given an independence, but that independence didn't achieve much because it was not recognized outside South Africa.
Yeah, international recognition. There was virtually no countries that recognized any of these. Yeah, and of course, it's one of many. I've just put a map up. I'm going to take it down to show. That's the Transkei map there with the capital at Umtata. Back in the day. And of course, not all of the country was contiguous. You had little pockets that were adjacent to it that actually didn't run borders. But I'd have to say that the Transkei borders were much easier than Bophuthatswana. Well, Bophuthatswana's borders were so confusing.
Yes, Transkei's independence had the minuses and its pluses, but the Transkeians take their heads off for K.D. Matanzima, mm-hmm. who started that process, in that he invested a lot of money in education. we might have not have had mines in that region, but education was our gold mine. Hence, I say we respect him because the black chartered accountants firms you are seeing now in South Africa, most of them are emanating from the people who were trained at the University of Transkei, and medical doctors, lawyers, judges. So he did very well, but politically, I guess he was on the wrong side.
Ah. Well, it's an interesting point that you bring up. And in fact, we'll get to the UDM and talk a little bit about that later in the stream. We're going to talk about your focus on education because that's, I think, a key part of what UDM stands for. And I'm going to guess that it probably comes from this origins of education playing such an important role back in the Transkei. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it's a fair statement, but obviously it was always expected that once we get our freedom in South Africa, the first layer of doing anything is to invest more on education, especially when you had neighboring countries like Zimbabwe, which also invested a lot in education, Botswana, Swaziland, and so on.
You know, that's a good point. In fact, if you look at Zimbabwe, the amount of money put in education from 1980 until things got tight in the late 90s was quite impressive. And you have whole generations of Zimbabweans who've grown up who are literate and well-educated, graduating from secondary school was the norm. And it was quite successful for a period of time there. So it was a good example for a long time, at least from an education standpoint. So I've put a map up here and showed the Bantustans for people not familiar with it, different ones, and you can see the boundaries there. Maybe a little small to see if you're looking at a mobile phone or a tablet, but you can watch this on a PC later on, or you can also look it up. But you can see the Transkei is located down there in along the border of what today is KwaZulu-Natal in the Eastern Cape province, and that's where it was physically located. Now, you joined the Transkei Defense Force when the country was new in 1976, correct?
Yes, I joined the Transkei Defense Force in July 1976.
So I know what prompted me to join the Army here in the U.S. Was it employment? Was it patriotism? Was it excitement about a new country? Or was it just the thing to do as a young man?
To be honest with you, I'm a product of a special school here called Jongilizwe College, a college which was a college for sons of chiefs. And in that college, we were taught leadership, and also we were taught lessons on patriotism, if I may call it that. Mm-hmm. It was along those lines that when I was recruited, because in January 1976, I joined the post office after passing matric in 1975, and then I joined post office for 6 months, and the recruitment agents of the SA of the Transkei Defense Force came and recruited us. And then I joined, I think we were two from the post office. Fortunately, the people who came to recruit me were my former colleagues at the Jongilizwe College who passed matric before me. And they said, yeah, we know you like rugby. If you join the Defense Force, you will be fit and you will obtain Transkei rugby colors. So come over. And then I quitted the post office. The rest is history.
Now, I don't think a lot of people know that about you. Rugby is actually kind of a big deal to you. I mean, you were part of the parliamentary rugby squad from 94 to 96 in Parliament. You've part of the Transkei Rugby Board from 82 to 84. And you also are president of the Combined Forces Sport back from 81, 83. You're a rugby fan. Of course, people know you very famously for being a Kaiser Chiefs fan. So that's a supporter for them. But I think people are less familiar with the fact that you're a fan of rugby. But you also played rugby. And I've talked to a few people that said you were formidable. Are they honest? Or are they just puffing you up? I've heard that you're quite good when you played in your days.
They are honest because firstly, I was very scared to be brought down, tackled hard. And as a result, I relied on my speed and my footwork, and I played at position number 14, that is the right wing, and not right wing in politics, but in
yeah,
football.
In rugby, yeah. Fair enough.
So, I scored a lot of tries. Even the one I scored in Ireland against members of parliament in that part of the world, I scored the winning try.
Sweet. That's awesome. Well, there's not a huge gap between us. You got a couple years on me, but if you're on the right wing, I'm a left wing, not politically, but on the rugby pitch. So maybe we could team up for a game of old timers someday and have a little fun.
You're welcome.
Sounds good. Well, let's talk a little bit about. So you enlisted in the Transcontinental Defense Force in 76, new country. 2 years later, got commissioned. By 85, you were brigadier general and eventually became a major general. And then eventually, after some political happenings and folks being ousted, you became the leader of the Transkei. And I believe you led the country into the transition to Democratic South Africa, correct?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, in 1976, after I finished the the basic training, I went to do this instructor's course, and after that, I was nominated to do the officer's course, and then I was commissioned in 1978. And during that period, K.D. Matanzima expelled the ambassador of South Africa in Transkei, and also expelled the military personnel who were training the Transkei Defense Force at the time. And then after that, we had to be accelerated to fill vacant posts, which were filled by the seconded staff. But the emphasis all the time was always, we must do military courses, train, train, train. And some of us were fortunate to have also been appointed to go and do courses abroad. And it was very difficult because not all the countries of the world recognized Transkei Defense Force or the Transkei for that matter.
So that's what happened. So because of the seconded officers from the South African Defense Force who were ejected, you were short leaders, and so they had to quickly come up with leaders. So, well, it sounds like for a young early period in life, people saw you destined for leadership, and obviously you were on the right path there. So we get to the end of apartheid, and we have CODESA, the Convention for Democratic South Africa. Now, there are lots of people with lots of different views on CODESA. In my view, it was a necessary event that had to take place to have a peaceful transition. And what happened in KwaZulu-Natal, we're not talking about that right now, but specifically about a peaceful democratic transition for the whole country, CODESA was important. Now, you were the lead delegate for the Transkei. That had to be an utterly fascinating process to be involved in that, just to be there at this time in history, to be part of CODESA. I think that's something that a lot of people probably should put pen to paper and write about their experiences in CODESA. I haven't seen much in the way of writing. What was that like for you?
Well, before I went to CODESA, we must also touch to the part of the history of Transkei, wherein, as a result of a corruption which was taking place in Transkei government, the military intervened, and we removed that government. And as a result, I became a head of Transkei government through a military coup, but not the one by Trump he was trying to do in Washington recently. So then we went to the time for negotiation came, and we assembled a team in Transkei, which included a former political party which was running Transkei before we took over. And then we also draw the delegation from the civil society, the lawyers, and so on. And then we succeeded at least to have a smooth transition in Transkei because no properties were destroyed, because people were resisting this change in South Africa. Neither did we have anyone killed as a result of resisting the change. So we always look at that period and compare it with other homelands and inside South Africa. I think young as we were at the time, I think we ran a smooth transition.
No, that's a fair point. I'm glad you raised that. I didn't mean to skip over that. I was focused on CODESA because it's such an interesting period of time. But no, it is a good point. We saw what happened in Bophuthatswana, and that wasn't pleasant, and other places. So yeah, no, it's a good point that a bloodless transfer or coup d'etat, if you want to say that, which is always helpful. I suppose it's good news about the recent one in Zimbabwe is when Mugabe was pushed aside, that was bloodless. That could have been quite nasty, but it was bloodless. So let's CODESA then. For you, was that, I can only imagine if I had been present and been involved in that, and I'm not talking about when a group stormed the building, I'm talking about just the whole process. It had to be interesting. And of course, back in those days, you knew a very young Cyril Ramaphosa because he was the lead negotiator for the ANC. So bringing all these groups together, the Pan-African Congress, the Bantustans, the National Party, the ANC, it had to be a very interesting event.
It was an interesting event, but we commend what Madiba did for the other parties, including Homelands, as well as other liberation movements, by inviting them to be part of the process. Of course, some other two liberation movements, if I'm not mistaken, rejected that offer. But still, even though we were not party to bilateral discussions with the Nationalist Party, Madiba would brief the leaders of the Patriotic Front with a view to keep us informed as to what has transpired in those negotiations. And the whole setup, as you know, culminated into an interim constitution. A constitution which was, Constitution of South Africa was drawn by elected members of parliament. Hence, it was only adopted in 1996.
No, absolutely. But it was a fascinating process from the outside. I can only imagine what it was like being inside, especially the day that the people rushed into the building. That was quite a day in itself. I'm sure there's a few temperatures raised that day and a few people concerned about their safety. But quite an interesting process. Now, you've mentioned corruption in the Transkei. Obviously, you moved because corruption had become so pervasive. But you also voted for no confidence vote against Zuma as president several times in parliament. Is it fair to guess that the reason you did that was because of your frustration with the corruption during that era? Or was there another reason that you voted for his vote of no confidence?
Well, as far as the UDM is concerned, we questioned the judgment of the ANC members in Polokwane, who opted to elect President Zuma, who was already facing criminal charges of corruption related matters. And we insisted that we are creating a wrong precedent. Of course, in 2019, we intensified these votes of no confidence with other political parties in the opposition. Such vote of no confidence debates culminated in us marching to union buildings. I remember very well, vividly well, I was appointed to coordinate that march. It's one of the biggest marches we've ever had in South Africa against a democratically elected political party. Yes, the ANC, of course, finished off by asking Zuma to do an honorable thing and leave the government. So that project was not an ANC project to ask their president to resign. It was a project of the opposition parties.
No, absolutely. And the reason I raise the corruption issue is because when we get to the UDM, that seems to be one of the important things that the UDM is concerned about, corruption, and something that believes needs to be addressed. So it shows a consistent pattern throughout your life in politics and the trans guy trying to root it out, also with Zuma. And as you said, he was already facing charges. Well, I don't know what folks in South Africa call this, but I call that the Polokwane massacre. when they had the ANC's conference, I call it the Polokwane massacre because Thabo Mbeki is unseated and then he resigns as president of the country. And it's then that I have to remind people outside South Africa that while South Africa is supposedly a representative democracy, it's really in many respects a parliamentary democracy because nobody votes for the president, the members of parliament do. Because people outside the country are like, okay, so he's not in charge of the ANC anymore. Why is he resigning as president? Well, because he might face a vote of no confidence from his own party if he doesn't resign. So that's an important distinction. It's about South Africa's democracy. It's different. You have a president. The UK has a prime minister, but you get your president in the same fashion that the UK gets its prime minister through a parliamentary vote. And I think a lot of people outside of South Africa are like, "What? What's going on? I don't understand that." It's quite strange for people that don't understand it. So you just have to understand what's going on. So what happened was you testified at the truth that, but you came into government, I'm sorry. So you came in with, as an ANC member, correct, in 94 and became a deputy minister back then for tourism?
Yes, in 1994, I joined the ANC and I was appointed a deputy minister of environment and tourism. Whilst I was at that stage, the ANC itself was encouraging people to go and testify about the things which were done wrong by the apartheid. In 1995, if I'm not mistaken, I did go and participate in the TRC activities. I merely went to the TRC to ask the commission to compensate the families of the deceased soldiers of the Transkei Defence Force then, who were killed in an abortive coup backed by Pretoria on the request of the former leaders we removed from power. And then my sin was to mention the name of Saul Kessler, a hotel magnate. It looks as though the leadership of the ANC panicked beyond comprehension because when I mentioned that name, all of a sudden they said I'm accusing Stella Starr of corruption. I said, no, this has been a reference to a historical point part of our history in Transkei, and and Stella Starr knows that part, and the public, except perhaps those who were in exile who might have not followed what was happening. But be that as it may, when Madiba said I must apologize so that this thing can be settled, so I refused flatly to apologize. I said, it's a question of principle, it's an event which I'm proud that I once participated to remove a corrupt system.
No, absolutely. That's so what happened is that you wound up parting ways with the ANC and then you wound up founding your own party. You did that with Rolf Meyer, correct? Back in the 1990s. You guys created the United Democratic Movement.
Yes, I started a movement called National Consultative Forum, where I was asking people of South Africa as to whether there is a need to establish a new political party. Whilst on the other hand, Rolf Meyer had problems with F.W. de Klerk's way of doing things, and he established his own new movement. And then we agreed that let's meet and compare notes. At the end of the day, we found each other that we are fighting for the same thing and that things must be done differently to avoid the mistakes of the past.
And out of that came the United Democratic Movement.
Yes, out of that came the UDM.
Okay, which has been around now for a couple of decades plus. And it although your vote total has been declining over the years, you still have two members in Parliament right now. You're one, and you have another member in Parliament at the moment, correct?
Yes, that's true. And you wouldn't think that we are only two when we speak, because we don't have time. We speak facts. And you would think that maybe we are the official opposition, because we're not howlers. We present facts. It's like on the corruption. And we have won a number of cases here in South Africa, many major cases as UDM, including the one which we forced the Speaker of Parliament to allow members of Parliament to vote secretly, whereas she was against that, and then we won that. So it's not about numbers, it's about quality.
Well, that's actually an important distinction. And of course, they didn't want a secret ballot because they were worried that Zuma would get a vote of no confidence. And we saw the difference between an open ballot and a closed ballot and how many more, obviously, ANC members voted for his expulsion or his no confidence. That's why they fear it. They fear the secret ballot because you can't intimidate people if you don't know what they're voting for. That's a big deal. So that was a huge thing. And then people kind of gloss over history and forget that that's a recent development, that there was an effort to make this so that they weren't secret ballots. Really difficult to run a political process if people can't vote their conscience because they fear intimidation by being exposed what they vote. And that's so good job for you guys standing up and for the other opposition parties for standing up for that. It was it had to be something very difficult to face. But wow, something else. So Rolf Meyer, is he still active with the party, or has he left the party, or is he still involved, or because he's still around?
Rolf Meyer resigned in year 2000 and retired completely from politics. He has been consulting internationally on peace settling disputes. Sometimes he's tasked by the ANC government.
Gotcha. Okay. No, it is interesting that I saw them they've brought opposition political figures in to be special envoys, to be ambassadors. Like famously, Tony Leon from the Democratic Alliance was brought in by the ANC to be South Africa's ambassador to Argentina, which is interesting. So interesting approach. You don't see that much here in the States. Political appointments to ambassadorial posts don't usually come from the opposite party. So that is interesting to see that. Now, I had a couple questions from folks here. I just want to get in. This is kind of a general one. So Chris Swanepoel asked if you're happy with the way politics went in South Africa for the past couple of decades compared to the dream that Madiba had. I guess he's saying, are you, and I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but are you happy with where things are now? Is it where you expected it to be 26 years ago?
To be honest with you, in the last 26 years, South Africa has done a lot of work for itself, for herself. And there are pluses and minuses we can point. For instance, in the rural areas and the townships and informal settlements, there are lights today. You've got certain areas where there's water. Let me say, the social security of the African National Congress in government is still the best as compared to many countries of the world, where people are given free houses and so on. However, I've noticed that we will have at some stage a revolt against the government if we are unable to sustain these free gifts we're giving to our people. What we need to do perhaps is to check as to whether are we not becoming a country of consumers, where we only eat what we have and we forget about tomorrow. Meaning therefore, we need to invest more now on our economy, and also the other embarrassing part is that in the last 26 years, we have failed to invest more on the majority citizens of this country with a view that they would become industrialists and produce things here in South Africa and be in a position to compete with the outside world. So I think the government on that side has failed dismally. You cannot expect out of 58 million population that 44 black South Africans are still queuing for jobs in companies which are owned by few of the 3 million white population. So we have to do something. In terms of the lawlessness, my background, as you know, I'm a security person. I'm not happy. It's too much. It's too much. There's no discipline. And even in this issue of this coronavirus, you can see that the lessons of national patriotism are still needed to be introduced in this country. And to say, let us inculcate a culture of ownership, like, this is my country, this is my city, this is my village, this is my home, this is my president, this is my government. We don't have that here, unfortunately. Even if you look at the way where we are unable to manage the waste management, and the people have, they just throw things everywhere. So I think the government, if they had the political will, of course, they would have addressed this, but it seems as if their priorities are elsewhere.
No, absolutely. You touched on a few key points there. That back as a young man, when I was a lieutenant before, and as I became a captain, that's when the news was. I actually was promoted captain the same month that the elections took place in 1994. So, but prior to that, I had said there's a few paths in my view at the time that South Africa need to focus on. The most important one being beyond the provision of services to the many people who didn't have access to electricity, clean drinking water, and such, education. It should have been job one. Well, job two. Security should have been job one. Nothing else works if you don't have a secure environment. Transition to police from a police force that's designed to accomplish certain things under the apartheid government to one that's involved in community policing, one that knows the communities it's involved in, that the officers are trained in restraint, they know how to do proper things. You have detectives that have the proper forensics capability to do investigations, and then the justice system actually prosecutes criminals. All of that's necessary. You got to fix that. You got to fix education. And you've got to be patient because it's going to take a couple of decades. You have a lot of South Africans whose only form of rejection of apartheid was not to go to school. And so you have a lot of people who grew up not well educated because they weren't going to school for a number of years. And then the other thing I suggested back then was a national sovereign wealth fund for something you just talked about there, General. And that's you're talking about an ownership society. That's what I talked about, a proper national sovereign wealth fund so that people in South Africa have a stake in its success and they see something coming back from it. But folks, you're listening to Chris White Africa here on the Indaba Africa channel on YouTube, part of the Indaba Broadcasting Network. My special feature guest today is none other than Major General retired Bantu Holomisa, a member of the South African Parliament and the president of the United Democratic Movement. We are talking about his personal history and just transitioning into now more recent events. And so, welcome to the channel. And I think a lot of people don't know that your full name is actually Bantu Bonke Harrington Holomisa. So I thought I'd share that because we all know you as Bantu Holomisa. So people probably always wonder, why do they call this dude Bantu? Bantu, if I'm not mistaken, means people, doesn't it? In several languages, yeah. So anyway, I thought I'd share that. Well, let's talk a little bit about the things you just talked about there. Now, the ownership society, the lawlessness—it is quite frightening. The lawlessness that takes place, the low regard that criminals seem to have for human life. And it's all human life. 60 South Africans are murdered every day on average. And it's very frightening. Cash in transit heists are very brutal. They execute people who don't even offer resistance, shooting in the back of the head in broad daylight with impunity. The robberies, gender-based violence, home invasions. Look, every country's got issues like this. But of course, it's very depressing in South Africa to see this sort of thing. And then, of course, an issue that that doesn't get the attention should get, from my perspective. In part because I think it's misrepresented. And this is the issue of rural security, as I talk about, and an issue of farm murders, which affect all South Africans, blacks, whites, coloreds, and Indians being murdered by people. But it must be very frustrating for you sitting in Parliament and seeing the ineffectiveness of the South African Police Service against this degree of crime?
It is, but at the same time, I'm aware that the reason why there is this incompetence among the law enforcement agencies is because some of them do not qualify. They have not been trained. They were just rewarded with ranks. And now we expect that individual to deliver. A small thing like intelligence, collection of intelligence, I mean, gathering intelligence and then collate it and come up with a conclusion, take a decision. Once you concluded that indeed this is the situation, and then you deploy people to deal with that. But professionalism in our law enforcement agencies, unfortunately, leaves much.
Are you still there?
To eat, and then no training. You citizens of the country. So there's a lot of work which we need to do. But the ANC has to accept that they made blunder by not including the other qualified South Africans, black and white, in key positions because some had experience.
No, absolutely. I think that's a big. I noticed something, and this isn't a black and white issue, but it's an important point. I think you're not stating it, but I think that it's an important point. And if you disagree with me, please let me know. But one of the things that Julius Nyerere told Robert Mugabe when he took over in 1980, he gave him advice. Julius Nyerere, of course, Mzee from Tanzania. He said that, listen, don't chase your white folks out or Europeans out because we made a mistake. We chased them all away from Tanzania and we had no experts, no specialists here. One thing I did notice, there was in education in South Africa when I was traveling around in the late 90s and early part of the 2000s, is an awful lot of Afrikaans qualified primary and secondary school teachers were being pushed into retirement or separation packages to leave the education service. And it seemed to me to have a very disastrous impact on the fact you had qualified teachers who could no longer teach, some of them not just in Afrikaans, obviously in Xhosa and other languages, and they weren't available anymore. And there weren't people prepared to take their place. And that's, you have to have patience to educate and train people to rise up in the ranks and replace them. It sounds like you're saying a similar sort of thing in the security services, where if you're qualified, you should be able to be in security services. It shouldn't be a question of what you look like. Oops, are you there? His connection is dying on me there. His connection is frozen up there. Let me see what's going on here. Let me take him off the screen here for just a second, folks. When he comes back in, we'll get him back in here. So my apologies for that. Looks like his connection is frozen. Let me send him a note very quickly on WhatsApp here. What's going on here? Just a second there. If he comes back on, we'll be able to hear him. Are we getting interdicted here? One has to wonder. So I've just sent him a message there. Sorry about that, folks. There we go. So, he's dropped off. Yeah, I've lost him. Okay. Yeah, he's gone. Anyway, folks, hopefully he'll call back in a moment. I'll keep it going in the meantime. But you're listening to Major General Retired Bantu Holomisa. Yes, folks, I appreciate the hard questions. There are hard questions here, but we have a specific pattern we're trying to get through here. I'm asking the questions from the Super Chats as I can get them in. Brett, I know yours is coming up. I've asked Chris Swanepoel, and obviously he's not happy. I think that you will find that a number of people who view my program are of a different opinion on some of the issues that General Holomisa. But you probably find common ground on many of these issues. Specifically, I suspect a lot of people probably would disagree with his assessment about the share of people involved in industrialization. And I think it's just a question of how people approach it. So we'll see if we get him back on here. Hopefully he'll get back here in a moment. But just give me a chance. Let me see if he's responded to my message. Nope. I think he lost his internet because my text message to him hasn't even gotten through. Wow. I've got no confirmation there. Teach a man to Wi-Fi. Aha, Ronaldo Chutz, you're here. I had a feeling you might tune in for this. And yes, I did have plans to talk to the general about the former mayor of Nelson Mandela Bay. That's right, folks. Bobani. Mongameli Bobani. I was going to talk to him about that. Maybe he got load shedding. That might be what it is, folks. Listen, so if we've lost the general because of load shedding or something like that, we'll try to get him back on and we'll continue. We won't run through the whole history when we get him back on of his background. We'll get to the meat of what we're getting to right now, which is the issues on the UDM as an opposition party going forward. And I will not forget that question about Bobani. We'll ask about that. So no load shedding today. You say that, but that doesn't mean that Eskom is delivering electricity to every house in South Africa. Why was load shedding suspended? What happened? Whose business did they shut down? Which platinum mines aren't getting electricity today so that they can have electricity for your houses? Yeah, I was enjoying the conversation too, and I appreciate the questions. Thanks a lot for sending them in and for the super chats that came in already. I do appreciate that. And to the 150 currently watching, thank you so much. Yeah, I can't tell him Stronger Together because his phone isn't receiving messages. Oh, okay, he got it. Okay, his message went through. Can you? Oh, here he comes. All right. Okay, apologies to the super chat. Looks like he's coming back. Yay! All right. All right.
Are you back?
I'm always been here. You're the one who left, sir.
I thought you were frozen.
No, it was your connection. We're good. We got you back. We got you back. Welcome back. No, I thought maybe it was load shedding. You never know. The embarrassment of Eskom.
Or a sabotage of some kind.
Well, it's that too. You know, we were just getting to talking about the ANC, so I was wondering if maybe the signal got cut. No, just kidding.
We're talking about ANC and also the march to the Capitol. So maybe too happy.
Well, let me get to this question since we had a brief break there for a moment. There was a question from one of my longtime viewers who, and this is kind of an esoteric question. He said, so what was your favorite thing about your time in the Transcai Defense Force and your least favorite? I mean, if someone asked me my favorite moment in the Army and least favorite, I can identify those. So what were your favorite and least favorite things about the Transcai Defense Force? It's been a couple of years, but I'm sure you remember something.
It was more about intensifying training of our troops and also exploiting the relationship we had with the ANC while it was in exile, in that the late Chris Hani and late Steve Chwete would organize with other countries for us to send our military officers for training. So I would always cherish those moments.
And what was the least favorite thing?
Well, it was a peacetime. There's nothing much. We're never under pressure in Transcai Defense Force. So there's nothing to talk about, really.
Gotcha. No, that's fair. Peacetime. War is maybe exciting, but it's also quite deadly. So, but peacetime and deterrence is always a big part of our missions in uniform. People forget about that. Oh, Anna Marie Nell told me, shh, don't wake up Eskom. No, we don't want to upset. They might actually start doing load shedding tonight. Well, let's shift a little bit there, General, and talk about the UDM. So I looked through core values for your party, and you talk about a lot of things that I find a lot of common ground with, and I think many South Africans would. So the core values in the UDM off the website for the party say respect for life, dignity, human worth of every individual, integrity in public and private life, individual rights and freedoms enshrined in the Constitution, tolerance and respect for the rights and freedom of others, freedom of religion and worship. These all sound like reasonable positions to take, and I suspect that they're core values for the UDM even today.
They are. In actual fact, many people always ask us, what is UDM stand for or fighting for? And I think today I must answer some of them who have that those questions. The UDM is a social democratic party that stands for inclusion, social development, and responsible economic empowerment. We put the people first and are guided by a strong moral compass, especially on the ethics of good governance. That is precisely why we are still occupying the crease in the last 26 years, in the last 22 or 23 years of our existence as a party, by merely saying, pointing out to the government that don't do A, B, C, D, E, because you are violating clause what in the Constitution and in the PMF financial regulations. We are proud of our vision and mission and what we stand for.
No, excellent. That makes all the sense in the world. So let me run through a couple of top issues here. I'll just run through a list of my I took off the site, which I think would be interesting for people to know more about. And we can focus on a couple of them. The UDM has concerns about energy and alternative energy. That's one. The national health insurance is another. The concern about creating dependency on the state. You sort of talked about that briefly a short while ago. Education, an important issue for UDM. Corruption, another important issue. Both education and corruption, long time issues for you personally, all the way back to the trans guy. And then UDM land reform issue, and then policing. These are all, I think, critically important issues here. And the UDM is involved in all of them. Well, I think we probably should put something to bed here very quickly, because I know a lot of people are not really sure where the UDM sits on land. So specifically looking at what your party has online about land reform issue, basically what you said is that the failure, I'm going to read directly from what it says on the site, the failure of the current government to make sufficient progress on equitable land ownership deprives South Africans of a vital national or nation building tool. And UDM maintains that the slow delivery of land occurs due to corruption, ineffective governance, and maladministration. Well, on that, sir, you and I find very much common ground. I've argued for a long time that the ANC has not been serious about this. The original 75,000 land claims filed from 95 to 99 have mostly been resolved. There are still about 1,000 outstanding. The subsequent window that was opened by Zuma with another 141,000 claims includes a lot of frivolous claims, some legitimate. But the government doesn't allocate much money. They'll spend money bailing out Eskom and Transnet and South African Airlines, and they don't put any money into land. This year, the amount of money that went into land was just a few hundred million rand to purchase land, yet they spent billions on the airline and on Eskom. So if you want to tackle one of those issues, which one of those is might be the one you want to talk about first?
Firstly, I think the issue of land needs to be discussed, debated openly by all. And I think the process we embarked upon in Parliament is a fair one. We are waiting right now, had it not been for this COVID pandemic, that legislation should have been debated and possibly been approved. Where we are making some amendments, advocating for amendments so that we speed up the land distribution. However, the UDM is, maybe it's because I come from a province which fought many wars against the British forces, and we won most of them. And the truth is that people were removed from the forceful removal took place long before 1912.
Yeah.
So we are against, therefore, of the cutoff date, which says we must only look on the land issues from 1912 up to date. That's not fair. That would mean that a lot of land, which people like in Ciskei and Transkei were taken to reserve areas, will perpetually stay there, because the land which they were forcefully removed by those wars, there's no chance that they would get that land, because it took place before 1912. Mm. So we would like that in this debate there must be fairness, and not just to do a thing to peace certain political gimmicks. I don't like this nonsense of pleasing certain people against the factual history of this country. Mm. So we are going to participate fully in this draft legislation which the ANC government has tabled. The second part is the issue of the environment. When I grew up in the rural areas of Transkei, we used to have witness proper ecosystems where there was a fencing off of grazing land, mealy fields, and so on and so on. And the sustainability and maintenance of the dams and rivers. But when I drive around the area now, I feel that the desertification is going to destroy that area. So I would implore, in fact, I've just been appointed as one of the commissioners in the SA Climate Change Commission for Climate Change in South Africa. I'm going to recommend strongly that there has to be a priority, that our environment must be given priority, given that the revenue of this country is dependent on tourism these days, no more on agriculture or mining. So I am looking forward to participate and see how these renewable energies could be improved so that they are sustainable for our rural areas. The third part, of course, is the question of competent administrators. I like to invest more on training. Maybe it's because of my background in the military. Mm-hmm. But the training of our civil servants, the people who are running our SOEs, I'm not happy with their competence. So there is a need to invest more on the public service, training, instill discipline, inculcate a culture of ownership, and of course, education. It is unfortunate that the sanctions which were imposed against South Africa's to force change has also affected the investment in areas like technology. In certain areas, we are lagging far behind for about 20 years. So there would be a need, therefore, to accelerate or invest more on training and producing people in various fields, either in the IT or even nurses and teachers. Mm-hmm. Colleges of education, colleges of nurses in this country were closed down in 1994. But now we are depending on recruiting people from outside. Some come with fake documents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's something I've noticed, as you see a lot of like physicians who come from other parts of Africa, and I've seen some of them practice, and I question whether they really are physicians and they just have fake documents or not. That's, I mean, if you're going to have a fake software engineer, that could be bad. But if you have a fake physician, that could be fatal. That's a really bad news. So that's important consideration. So you're saying the teacher colleges were eliminated. So I probably should bring them back.
Yes, if I were to be given a power for six months or so, That would be my priority, because if you change syllabus, you need to make sure that the teachers mm-hmm. understand that change. And the best way is to introduce that kind of syllabus for the country. Mm-hmm. In fact, in this country, as far as education is concerned, we need a big indaba, wherein we can identify pillars of our education. And that those pillars, whoever come and become a government, they would never willy-nilly change those pillars without consulting the community or the South Africans. Right now, we are victims of, if there is a cabinet shuffle, and the Minister of Education is removed, then he or she is going to come up with his or her own syllabus. Some have even went to New Zealand to gather syllabus which was already in the dustbins of New Zealand. So we need an education in Daba wherein we can say, yeah, in this country, we are going to have all levels or this kind of system for this category. And then that when this matriculant leaves school, at least if he has, he or she cannot make to university, he or she should start his or her own business. So that means there has to be an introduction of a commerce subject for everyone, mathematics, you name it.
Sounds like a different focus of curriculum. You mentioned of land degradation, particularly in the Eastern Cape you were talking about. Do you see that as a consequence of misuse, overuse, and or climate change, or all of that together?
All of that together, but in particular, the overuse. Remember that in Transkei, we don't have enough space in the homelands. You were told, stay here. The lucrative part of the area was taken away during the 18th century. So that is the land which we say it should be distributed fairly and say those who want to produce food, here is your piece of land. Here is the access to capital. Here is the equipment. You start up in the next 10 years. You will be, 5 years, we will support you. After that, you are on your own. So the climate change, therefore, is affecting also the area. Mm. If you read the recent storms which took place in that part of the world, you will realize that yes, it is here. If people don't believe it, hard luck. That is here.
Hard luck. I like that. That's good. when you started the party, your first election you stood for was in 99 and did reasonably well. You picked up almost 3.5% of the vote at almost 550,000 votes. But in the national elections, the fortunes have declined over the years. Now, but you're not alone. You're not the only opposition party. Inkatha Freedom Party did very well, not as well as it should have done, but very well in the 94 elections. But they've continued to decline. I attributed their performance when Zuma came to power is people voting ANC because of Zuma. But even after he left in 2019, a lot of Zulu still voted for the ANC who used to vote for Inkatha Freedom Party. So the question I have is for the UDM going forward, do you have a plan or an idea for the party to drum up more support and raise your vote total again? Is that an objective? I would think it would be an objective. You want to get the vote total back up, get some more seats in parliament, and perhaps grow the party because it seems to have been declining in support. And there may be a lot of reasons for it, but I suspect you probably want to grow it again.
Yes, it was not our design that we should lose members, but the floor crossing legislation meant that we are going to be a target. And indeed, we lost good officers, good members of parliament. Some ANC appointed them as ambassadors. Some are advising the president as we speak. Good material, but we are not moaning, we're not whinging, we're just stating a fact that once you get your people are enticed and taken away, and then that affects your human resources, that affects your resources, financial resources. But be that as it may, we think that the timing is correct now, is right for us. Our ascendancy plan by 2024, definitely with all these scandals you are seeing now, at least it's going to help us. In particular, and I hope that Zondo Commission would come up with a resolution which says, no political party, which if it is in power, would receive monies which monies which have been planned properly to be channeled through a certain company. And that company is used as a conduit to channel that money back to the party head office of a ruling party. That has been proven. The members of the ANC have said, yes, Bosasa gave us so many billions for our rallies, for our congresses, for feeding our people, for buying T-shirts. If the playing field can be leveled, I promise you, things will be different in 2024.
Well, 2024 is a long way off. And what I've been telling people since April of 2020, opposition parties, is that you really need to hit the ground now. People in the DA and the Freedom Front Plus and other parties are talking about trying to grow their membership. And I advise parties like that, if you want to grow your membership, you have to be in townships, you have to be in mining hostels, you have to be in rural areas, you have to connect with South African voters, you have to convince the 17 million South Africans that don't bother to vote that they should register and they should vote because they're eligible and vote for your party. Now, 2021, assuming the municipal elections take place, given all the resentment over the tobacco ban, the alcohol ban, open-toed shoe ban, e-commerce ban, I could go on, sir, all day with what the ANC has been doing in its response to COVID-19. But a lot of people are really, really not happy with the ANC across the country. And to me, it seems like a golden opportunity for opposition parties to grow their base and draw more support. Is your party looking at this as an opportunity to find disaffected voters from the ANC, or have you thought a strategy out for that?
In the past couple of years, we've seen that the ruling party's membership is declining in terms of the vote. People who vote for it are declining to vote for it. So that's why they lost big metros in the last local government election. And again, I coordinated a lot of meetings during that period, establishing government in Johannesburg, a metro, in Port Elizabeth, and also Pretoria, and. So we feel that the politics of coalition in South Africa are the politics of the future. The level of corruption we've witnessed has led to many to believe that one-party dominance is not okay. One-party dominance breeds corruption because it lacks checks and balances. Therefore, the future of municipalities here, I think they will continue to be run under the lines of coalition. But let's talk about 2021 local government election.
All right, let's talk about it.
depending as to whether the COVID-19 will go away and all these lockdowns and allow a period of marching towards normality where people can do rallies and do door-to-door campaigns. As long as that period, setup is not known, when will it end? I begin to doubt if we will even have the local government elections in 2021. I don't think Cyril Ramaphosa's government is ready to have a press conference tomorrow and say, the lockdowns are a thing of the past, given the number of people who are dying, especially under this second wave. So I doubt very much. But if local government do take place, expect that there's going to be a lot of contestation, which would be good for our democracy. We will be there.
I agree with you. It would be fantastic for democracy. And I think that, as I've told people, that in the 2020 municipal elections, assuming they go forth with the level of discontentment with ANC, not just over coronavirus, but in recent history, I think the 2019 national elections, from my view, is an election that was kind of an anomaly. The ANC, while it wasn't popular and its vote declined, still kept the majority, in part because I think one of the main opposition parties, the Democratic Alliance, fumbled the ball. they really confused their voters as to what they were for and what they were against, one way or the other. People weren't sure, and it cost them. So some smaller parties did gain votes, but so I think that was kind of an anomaly, the 2019 national. I think the 2021 municipal elections, assuming they go forward, could really show a difference. And you touched on something there, sir, about about coalitions. A lot of people are talking about coalition governments in South Africa. At the national level, I'm not sure how that's going to work. Maybe in 2024 we can see a change, but certainly in 2021, there's a very good chance that coalition politics could work in Nelson Mandela Bay, in Tshwane, in Johannesburg, maybe even in Durban. ANC, surprisingly, has lost more support in Durban than I would have expected. So going forward, it sounds like the coalition politics is something that does appeal, especially for a small minority party. Now, your party's actually been involved in these, as you mentioned, in Joburg and Tshwane and Nelson Mandela Bay in the past. In fact, you had the deputy mayor of Nelson Mandela Bay, and this is kind of a sore subject for some people I'll bring up, but recently passed away former deputy mayor and Mayor Bobani, who was part of your party. He served there under Athol Trollope and then subsequently as the mayor, as that coalition fractured and held together, fractured and held together. I think that the Nelson Mandela Bay situation shows an instance where you can form a coalition, but you've got to be careful about your coalition because that was a very fractious coalition and it nearly collapsed several times, eventually did. Whereas the coalition in Pretoria has been much more solid in Tshwane. So what are your thoughts about those coalition governments? Do you see your role in 2021 as perhaps gaining more of the vote and playing kingmaker or contributor in some of these municipalities like you did in 2016?
I think we will continue to have coalition governments in these metros. But what we need to do as a country is perhaps to have a sort of a guideline gazetted so that you guide the political parties that in the event that a government cannot be established or formed after elections, the legislation or that government gazette must say, for instance, you are given so many months to sort out your things. If you fail, we will do a rerun of the election. Number two, the guidelines of the coalition should also include as to if you have bigger numbers, don't think that you are going to be a big brother in a coalition. Mm-hmm. You must learn to listen to these small parties who have forced you to lose the big numbers. Mm-hmm. And they are representing a certain constituency and they have certain interests to be served by that particular municipality. So, We need to run workshops. There's a good model in Germany. There's another one in New Zealand. If we can look into those two countries, I think South Africa could come up with a strong coalition government in future, which would depict the diversity of South Africa, which is composed of many interest groups. You are not going to wish them away.
Yeah. They're there. They're not going anywhere. But I think one of the challenges you face, General, is that the ANC is not looking to Berlin. It's looking to Beijing all the time. It's constantly looking to Beijing. And I'm not sure that really helps South Africa's democratic process. That's just an opinion. I'm not sure your view on it. But you were mentioning earlier, if you were in charge for 6 months, well, okay, here, I'm just going to make it possible. Tomorrow, I'm calling for a vote of no confidence against President Cyril Ramaphosa. And guess what? I win. So now we have to elect a new president for South Africa in the parliament, and I'm putting forth Bantu Holomisa as my candidate. And I've twisted enough arms and convinced enough people in the back room with enough schnapps and Kassel Lager, and I've convinced them to vote for you. And so now you are president of South Africa. Would you have handled the COVID-19 situation in South Africa any differently? Was there an approach that you as the leader of South Africa might have taken that's different than what Ramaphosa and the National Coronavirus Command Council have taken? So you're king for the day, or president for the day, I should say. Would you have handled it in any different fashion, or are you pretty much happy with how they've done it?
Firstly, the UDM and other political party leaders were consulted by the president when we started the lockdowns. And he outlined the plan and we approved it. But unfortunately, he had ministers who came up with regulations which contradicted each other. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of incompetence. So therefore, in terms of fighting COVID-19, I think as a country, we did well. But unfortunately, when it comes to balancing the loss of lives and livelihoods, some ministers seem to have focused only on the question of saving lives only. Hence, the economy of the country is in tatters. Mm. So therefore, I would make sure that the Balancing Act is applied and make sure that all the interest groups are listened to so that you come up with an inclusive plan to combat this COVID-19. Lastly, these ministers and bureaucrats have again let Cyril down on the issue of the vaccine. I mean, we are members of the G20, we are members of BRICS. Mm-hmm. All our fellow members are rolling out vaccine. And it's not a question to say South Africa doesn't have money. Now I'm beginning to think this delay, perhaps, is it because they want to have a company or issue a tender to a company which would pay back to them?
Mm. Wow. You sound like an American conspiracy theorist there. No, but I mean, seriously, this is a question that doesn't get addressed. And you're in Parliament. I'm not asking you to divulge this because it's something from Parliament. But I mean, the public wants to know. The African Development Bank in July gave South Africa $285 million loan. In August, the New Development Bank, or the BRICS Bank, gave South Africa $1 billion in a loan. And then also in August, the International Monetary Fund gave $4.3 billion. That's $5.6 billion with the exchange rate at the time, which was in my favor, 18 to 1. But I couldn't travel to South Africa, so I couldn't profit from that. Now it's 15 to 1. But at 18 to 1, that's 90 billion rand. The entire vaccination program to vaccinate the entire country is estimated by the government at 20 billion rand. Well, that's four times over the money. Where did that $5.6 billion go from August until today? How do they have no money to pay for this? It's a fair question. You're in Parliament, so I don't know if you know the answer or if you could share it because it might be something's classified. No,
we've made noise about this, including the 500 billion
yes.
rands earmarked for COVID-19. So I guess now this year in Parliament, the questions will be directed to various ministries as to what happened to those monies. But in terms of it rolling out the vaccine, we wouldn't even have to think of going to IMF or whoever. We have money. Mm-hmm. But their priorities are lopsided.
Well, I think that's a fair statement. Gosh, their priorities are lopsided. Well, General Bantu Holomisa, I don't want to keep you all day. You've been very generous with your time. I'd love to talk to you for hours. This is fascinating. I've already come across a couple points where you and I disagree, but we are still having a cogent conversation. Pretty much most of what you said, I'm if I was in South Africa, I'd consider, you know, checking into your party, maybe voting for it. But it should be interesting 2021 what comes up there. But what I'd like to do is issue an open invitation to you or another representative of your party. If you'd like to come back on the channel sometime, I'll invite you back as we get closer to elections to talk about if you'd like, so people can hear more about what your party's about. But before we go, is there anything you'd like to share with folks out there? Bear in mind, it's an international audience, but there's a lot of South Africans in the audience. Anything you'd like to share with them, either about the UDM or COVID or hope for the future, or no promotion to Kaiser Chiefs. This is not a soccer channel. You can promote rugby, but no Kaiser Chiefs promotion here. No, I'm just kidding. Whatever you'd like to say, any thoughts you'd like to share with us?
No, what I would like to say to the audience, which is watching this program, is that people, this COVID-19 is a killer. Mm. Let us not underestimate it. It would be good to take the view of the scientists. We listen to the politicians. We listen to the ministers of police. But at the end of the day, we as individuals, we must be responsible and also be the policeman to police your neighbor. And when you find that he's flouting the regulations, you tell him or her. Good luck.
There you go. There was something here I just want to share very quickly. There's an American who's a huge fan of South Africa, and he knows a lot about South Africa's participation in the Korean War, and he wanted to know if you were aware that the South African Air Force was involved in the Korean War, and that the pilots were all white, but most of the maintenance crews were black South Africans who went there, and they did a fantastic job, made a major contribution to the Korean conflict. He talks about it all the time, so he's just curious if you happen to know about it, so I just thought I'd ask that question.
They went right where?
In South Korea, in the Korean conflict, back in the 1950 to 53, the South African Air Force went, all white pilots, but black maintenance crews.
That's the history which I wouldn't be interested in. I don't know anything of.
Well, it's quite a while ago, so there you go. Anyway, let's see. I'm going to make sure I missed anything else here. Oh, yeah, I did ask a question. We touched on Nelson Mandela Bay. So, all right. Well, sir, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. And as I said, the door is open. You're welcome to come back anytime. In lockdown, all I'm doing is growing this ridiculously long beard in lockdown.
Next time I'll bring I'll delegate my deputy president, Ngabayom Sikwangwa, who sits in the Portfolio Committee for Finance and the Economic Cluster in Parliament. So that you could talk about how do we get out of this quagmire wherein we are importing almost everything in this country, whereas South Africa was once an exporter of many things, yeah, including food. But today, of course, we understand the issues related to that we are members of the WTO, mm-hmm, that we are members of the Global Village. But we cannot sustain our economies if we just open the floodgates. Because if you want to be a president, for instance, in France, if you are not going to promise the farmers that you are going to subsidize them, you will never be a president. So there are certain areas where we have to say, yeah, we protect our people. We will trade with you. But this dumping business, I'm against it.
No, I understand where you're coming from. Before the expiration of the multi-fiber agreement in 2005 from the World Trade Organization, South Africa produced 70% of the clothing sold in the country and 90% of the shoes. Today, it's about 10% of the shoes are produced in South Africa and about 20-25% of the clothing. The rest is all imported from Asia. And with that went hundreds of thousands of textile industry jobs and then all the jobs around that. So I understand exactly where you're coming from. I don't think you're arguing for protectionism, but you're arguing for fairness. Is that correct?
I'm arguing for fairness, but at the same time that the raw material we have in South Africa must be processed here so that we create more jobs. Mm-hmm. Then we can export and compete with others on the international line, but to be on the receiving end every day and they take the raw material, process them, and then dump them back here, I'm against that.
No, absolutely. I got you. That's goes back to the whole argument with Kwame Nkrumah and smelting aluminum in Ghana and the Akasambo Dam, and you know, now we're importing the stuff we're supposed to be making it here. And so, no, I got you. It makes all the sense in the world. Well, I look forward to getting your deputy on the channel, so I'll chat with you offline, and we'll try to get that set up. That'll be fascinating, I think, for people. But, sir, once again, it's a pleasure having you. It's for me, I've known who you were for a long time because, of course, I followed the events in the Bantu stands back in those days. And so you're already a known personality to me back then. And so it's a pleasure to finally get a chance to talk to you, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation. It was less an interview and more a conversation. That's how I like to do it. But once again, you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll let him step out of the stream. That's Major General Retired Bantu Holomisa, who is the president of the United Democratic Movement in South Africa. Let me put him in the waiting room there. Where is he at here? Put him in waiting room. There we go. Whoa, that's all messed up. I have to remember to fix that. So there we go. Anyway, folks, thanks a lot for tuning in. I really appreciate it. Very kind of you to join us for the stream today. Obviously, there are things that not everybody agrees with. For instance, what the general had to say about land and about a date going before 1910. I disagree with that. My view is that you can play this into infinity. Someone made the point that the Afrikaners in South Africa could make claims to KwaZulu-Natal because Dingane granted them rights to be in Zululand. He gave them land for them returning cattle that he claimed were stolen by another group, and they fulfilled that agreement. But that's not how it worked out. So yeah, there has to be a date. But I certainly empathize and understand where he's coming from. With events in the Eastern Cape and land dispossession and land return. It's a very complicated issue. I think at the end of the day, reasonable minds can come to a reasonable conclusion. And but I've always been of the opinion 1910 was the Kudesa Agreement was the right date to pick, but that's just, but on many of these issues, I think that many people in South Africa will find that you're not that far out of alignment with General Holomisa. As far as corruption, yeah, folks, corruption's there in South Africa, but this is a gentleman who has consistently tried to fight against corruption for nearly 40 years. Well, I won't go into that comment right now, but anyway. So I just want to thank everybody for tuning in. I appreciate the watching this. I hope that you got it. Chris says, with all due respect, many of his so-called trained law enforcement couldn't read. Yeah, you're talking about the trans guy. Yeah, okay, fair. But the trans guy came into being in 1976. If he had illiterate policemen, that's not really the trans guy's fault, is it? The trans guy didn't train those people and educate them. If in 1987 they had illiterate policemen, well, that some of the responsibilities should be borne by the trans guy. So in the interest of full disclosure there, Chris, you gotta look at this in a holistic perspective. But anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation and the interview. I really enjoyed it. It was a pleasure to talk to him. And I appreciate General Holomisa for following through as he promised to do. It was wonderful to get him on here. And by the way, he picked the rugby jersey. Today is the 2019 Rugby World Cup jersey, the home jersey for the Springboks. I had a host of jerseys here knowing he was a former rugby player, and I let him select, and this is the one he selected. So, no, Chris, I got you. No grudge against him, but memories, yeah, no, I got you. Well, I don't think he was trying to make it all roses. We're trying to be civil here. There are a number of issues where he and I would disagree, but I was here to interview him, not to interject my views all the time. So, yeah. But it's another opportunity, another option for South Africans to look at. You've got lots of opposition parties to pick from. And just think about it. So anyway, there you go. So that's Bantu Holomisa and the United Democratic Movement. Anyway, so we'll get his deputy on here and talk to him about more policy things coming up in the future. If you're not a subscriber to Chris White Africa, hey, why not become one? Smash the subscription button right down there. Be sure to toggle the bell icon to get notified of updates. And if you don't mind, smash the like button. 136 likes. We had 170 people watching this at one point. 136 likes. Come on. If nothing else, you could like the way that the interview was conducted. Yes? Anyway, folks, thank you for your support. And there we go. Just jumped up to 140. Appreciate it. That's four more. There's plenty more we can get from that. But thank you for this. And I'll have more folks coming up on the channel for interviews. But thank you. And what else? Will I do a Night Owls? That's an hour from now. I'm not sure I'll do a Night Owls tonight, because I've already done two streams today, so I'll probably call it for the day. Thank you all so much. I need to get busy scanning these photographs from my mother's collection when she passed away, so I'm working on that. Sloth Puppy says, sadly, I'm not impressed with South African political leaders. Well, Sloth, take a number. I'm not impressed with American ones. Sky Greg T says, thank you for an interesting stream. Well, it's my pleasure, Sky, and thank you, Greg. Thank you guys for popping in. And yeah, the Telegram group is there. If you want to join the Telegram group, it's free. If you're a paying member of Chris White Africa, you can also join the WhatsApp group, which is limited only to members, but you have to send me an email. Anyway, folks, thanks for the super chats. Dreon, I don't think I got the answer you're looking for, but it wasn't going to go with the flow. So I did address, bring up the issue of coalitions, Bobani. I know where you're going for that, Dreon. Thank you. I didn't miss the super chat. I tried to work it into the conversation, just didn't work out quite as well as I wanted to. Anyway, so thank you for that. No kung fu, not on this. This is professional, no playing around at the end of this, so we'll save that for later. Anyway, thank you so much for the super chats, Brett, and for Dreon, and who else sent the super chats? Chris Swanepoel sent a super chat. Thank you all so much. No WhatsApp, no Facebook. Says Malcolm Stark. Okay, well, Telegram's available. You can go to the Telegram group. It's available. I'm considering making a group on Gab. But Gab has been unreliable of late because it's been swamped by the flood of people clamoring and stampeding over to Gab. But I will consider putting a group up on there. But for now, you can join the Telegram group, which is available, and it's very busy. It's always hop. Every time I look at my phone, it's hundreds more posts have been in there since the last time I looked at it. Let me just look right now. So I'm looking at the Telegram group right now, and since I last looked at it, we now have 244 members, and there have been 507 messages since I last looked at it a few hours ago. Wow. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people have just joined. Wow. Wow, look at that. 7, 8, wow. So 244 folks. Yeah. So anyway, thanks a lot. God bless. I'll catch you guys tomorrow on Chris White Africa. Once again, my special thanks, or my thanks to my special guest, Major General Retired Bantu Holomisa, a member of South Africa's Parliament and the President of the United Democratic Movement. Thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it. All right, guys. There you go. That's it. Make sure I got everything set here for the close, and we'll get out of here. And we'll catch you here next time on Chris White Africa. All right, folks, God bless and good night. Where's it at? There it is. Whoops. That's not right. That's the wrong one. There we go.